Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue with our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. We're in a stretch of 8 days in a row on pandemic-related issues. Today, it's when and how to open schools. It came up in Thursday night's debate, with Trump taking the simple, universal position he's been taking all along.
I want to open the schools. The transmittal rate to the teachers is very small, but I want to open the schools.
As for Joe Biden, he didn't exactly disagree about opening the schools, but he knocked Trump and the Senate Republicans for not passing bills to give schools the financial support he says they need if they are going in person and keeping people safe.
They need a lot of money to open. They need to deal with ventilation systems. They need to deal with smaller classes, more teachers, more pods. And he's refused to support that money, or at least up to now.
With me now on this is Emily Oster, economist at Brown University. She's best known for her books on pregnancy and early childhood called Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. These days, she is keeping an online dashboard that follows the confirmed COVID-19 case rate in schools. Earlier this month, she had an article in The Atlantic called Schools Aren't Super Spreaders. Professor Oster, thanks for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me again. Nice to be here.
And let's start off the politics by looking at your data. Can you tell people about your dashboard project and what you're trying to track?
Yeah, so the dashboard project is trying to track COVID cases in schools, and in particular trying to start at the school level. So trying to start by collecting some data on how many kids are at school in person, what kind of mitigation strategies schools are taking, and then to track the schools over time and look at how many COVID cases they have and you know, use that to try to learn something both about overall what are the risks look like, at least in this set of schools, and also what is kind of mitigation factors are mattering.
So your Atlantic article came out on October 9th. It's more than 2 weeks later. As total case counts are exploding around the country, is your conclusion today still that schools are not super spreaders?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we really need to distinguish between sort of two scenarios. One is the question of, is COVID spreading a lot in schools? And the other is the question of, are there some people affiliated with schools, attending schools, who have COVID? And as the case rates in the community go up, we are going to see people who are associated with schools, students and staff who are getting COVID. But what we really need to be focused on is, are they getting it at school? And I think what we are seeing, you know, in our data, but also in other data, is really that it does not look like schools are themselves sources of outbreaks, particularly schools with younger children. Now, of course, as COVID rates go up, we're seeing more people with COVID. And I think that part of what's, I think a lot of us are struggling with here, is that in order to protect our schools and keep it, make it possible for schools to be open, we really need to do more to lower community spread.
In our previous segment, our guest was the managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, who cited a stat that there have been 25 what she called outbreaks at schools around the state already. Is that consistent with your understanding? And how should people hear a stat like that in terms of concern or policy toward opening and closing, in your opinion?
So I think one question you want to ask is, what do you mean by an outbreak? So I don't know how New Jersey is defining that, but in a number of places, an outbreak is defined as, you know, two or more cases. It's not always clear that they're associated with each other. And so I think we want to be a little careful about how sure we can be, or how confident we can be, that those cases are actually spreading in schools. But again, I would say, you know, we are seeing, there are people in schools who have COVID, but what we're not seeing, at least, you know, at the moment, is a lot of cases in which there's a lot of spread inside the school. And given how important in-person learning is for learning outcomes, I think we really want to be careful about making sure that we are getting the right data here and really understanding what it's telling us.
You know, my producer heard a researcher on the podcast This Week in Virology. And yes, listeners, for those of you who are not virology nerds, there is a podcast called This Week in Virology, say that he's seen an uptick in patients since schools reopened, but not so much because they're a transmission site, the schools, as parents seem to be taking reopening as a sign that they can have birthday parties and other gatherings now. So I'm curious if your data reflects a secondary relationship like that to the rise in cases with in-person schooling.
Yeah, our data, I don't think that our data is sort of sufficient to separate out where are people getting COVID. But I think it's right that, you know, a lot of things have happened at the same time and that there has been sort of a general sense of opening. And I think that we're seeing, for example, when I talk to schools, they say, you know, when they contact trace their cases, they say, you know, we're seeing a lot of stuff come out of youth sports, come out of football, come out of, you know, parent parties at, you know, parents have a homecoming party because the school is not having one. I think that it's an interesting question of, you know, if we message that somehow, you know, schools opening means that everything can open, I think that's probably not the right message.
Listeners, our guest, if you're just joining us, is Brown University Professor Emily Oster, who's tracking coronavirus cases tied to schools. And we can take questions or your observations, your experiences for her at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. And since we're doing this as part of our election series, 30 issues in 30 days, what do you want from Trump or Biden, or what do you want from any elected officials on down the chain as a matter of policy around coronavirus in schools? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Emily standing by her article from October 9th in The Atlantic called Schools Are Not Super Spreaders. So in that article, the case rate that you cite among teachers, which is, I think, where the bigger concern is in terms of who's more likely to get seriously ill, the case rate among teachers and other staff that you cited was only around 2 infections per 1,000 staff. I wonder if you make a case for what's ethically acceptable. So, like, if I'm the president of a teachers union, I'm probably going to say, it's immoral to put the lives of 2 teachers out of every 1,000 teachers, you know, with all the thousands of teachers, maybe millions of teachers in the country. That's a lot of people who could be at risk for seriously getting ill, as compared with ramping up the best quality remote learning that people can ramp up for one more school year until presumably there's a vaccine and better treatments and the pandemic fades. So what would you say to that hypothetical teachers union president?
I mean, I think that the issue is that it isn't clear at all that when we cite that number 2 in 1,000, that's not 2 in 1,000 people got it at school. That's 2 in 1,000 people who had it, who are associated with the school. And so what we like to understand is, are those people getting it at school or are they getting it elsewhere? And what I was saying initially is it looks, when people have done contact tracing, it looks like those infections are largely coming from outside of the school. So actually closing the school in that case is not going to prevent those 2 infections. Closing the school will just mean that people have those infections and they have those infections anyway. And one way to see that in our data is to say, you know, we have schools that are operating remote only, where the students aren't there, the teachers, in some cases, are in person. Which people have sometimes thought, okay, that's safer because, you know, the students aren't there to infect the teachers. But actually, the infection rates in those cases are basically the same as the infection rates where the kids are in person. So it looks like, it's sort of like, I think we have this instinct like, oh, well, we want to protect those teachers. But it isn't clear that closing the schools is going to do that at all. And in fact, in the case of kids, I think it's likely, or at least people have suggested, that because of the kind of other things parents will be doing with their kids, that if we keep schools closed, there may actually be higher infection rates in kids than if we have them open.
You make the point that the students who lose out academically by remote learning systems are disproportionately low-income students of color. But we also see here in New York, where parents have a choice, that those families are choosing remote learning more than whiter and more affluent kids are. Have you seen those numbers? And if you agree that's the case, why do you think that is?
So I think there's a couple, I have seen those numbers. I think that's reflected elsewhere as well. And I think there's a couple of things going on. I think one is that those families do tend to be living in circumstances in which it is, you know, maybe riskier. So in multi-generation households, in which perhaps they're worried, especially worried about kids bringing, you know, COVID home, which could happen. I think the other thing is that we haven't done a great job communicating, and I think people are afraid. Teachers are afraid. Kids are afraid. Parents are afraid. I think we need to sort of think about helping people understand how large the risks are, and then helping to make the right choices for their families, which, you know, may differ by demographic group. But I think it would be a shame for that to happen because of fear that was not calibrated with the size of the actual risk.
I see you tweeted something today or retweeted something today from the writer Alec McGillis, who wrote, "I made a mistake a few weeks ago. I assumed that once private schools resumed in-person instruction, the contrast with public school remote learning would be too awkward to endure. I was wrong. In my cities and many others, that gap is now reality, and it's just the way it is." Why did you retweet that from Alec McGillis comparing public schools and private schools?
I mean, I think this has been a sort of interesting and somewhat upsetting aspect of this, that in a lot of places, particularly low prevalence places like San Francisco, Boston, what we've seen in the opening is that the public school district remains closed while private schools, in some cases Catholic schools, are open, and it's generated yet more of this kind of inequality that already exists in the education system. So somehow now it's not just that there's differences in quality of school, but literally there are differences in whether kids are able to go to in-person. And I had the same instinct that Alec did, that, you know, if we can see that private schools have started to open, that Catholic schools have started to open, that charters have started to open, and that they've started to do so successfully, that would push, at least in low prevalence areas, that would push the public districts to do more opening. I think we haven't seen as much of that as I expected.
Looks like we have a fan of your writing calling in from Edison, New Jersey. Heather in Edison, you're on WNYC with Brown Professor Emily Oster. Hi, Heather.
Hi. First of all, I have to tell you, your book, Expecting Better, saved my sanity while I was pregnant, so thank you very much.
Thank you. That's so great.
literally. And I recommend it to anybody who is pregnant and reading lots of books. Just read her book. We're debating whether to send our son into the hybrid mode here in Edison, because we're seeing that it's really difficult for him. He's only six. To do the online learning, but we're really nervous as we're both opera singers. We really obviously nobody wants to get this, but we don't want any long lasting effects for him, for us. So we're really nervous about doing it, but the ratio of students that have opted in for the hybrid mode is so low. Have you noticed in your data that if there's a low amount of students versus a higher amount of students, the difference in infection rate? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something that I think we still need to be able to dig into a little bit more. We do see slightly higher rates for the places that have full-time in-person learning, but somehow, perhaps ironically, those actually tend to be places with very high prevalence. So the most of the places that have pretty dense school classrooms are places like in the upper Midwest and in the South, which have had very high case rates. So it's a little hard to separate those things out. I think the one thing that has for sure happened is as places have gone hybrid, as you see, like a lot of people do not opt in. And so in a sense, it's sort of de-densifying the classroom already. So the kinds of things that we'd like, which is, you know, more distancing, is generated by the smaller number of kids in the classroom. Mm-hmm.
Heather, I hope that's helpful. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Helpful.
And Emily, I'm sure there are a lot of listeners right now who would say that you saved their sanity when they were pregnant through your book, Expecting Better, or after the child was born with your book, Crib Sheet, which covers from birth to preschool. Is there a natural development of your own work through those books to now you being the maven of all things coronavirus in schools?
I started doing this school stuff because I was writing a lot, you know, for this audience about kind of decision-making and how to decide about daycare and how to decide about seeing grandparents. And I think that's been a big struggle for a lot of us. But, you know, honestly, the school stuff that I started really came from a feeling that there was a kind of fall down of leadership at the really at the federal level, but to a lesser extent at some state levels, in terms of kind of tracking this information. And I kind of you know, you played the clip from the debate at the top, and I, mm-hmm. I really resonated with what Biden said, which is, you know, that that kind of it may be the right choice to have people in more kids in classrooms, and that obviously is what I think. But I think it's very clear that we need to make this a priority, and we need to give resources to it, and we need to, you know, be tracking better in the data and understanding it better. And that's where it's really been very frustrating that we've kind of not made this something that is important.
Here's a tweet from a listener that backs up what you were saying about why the families in the most at-risk neighborhoods, lower income and people of color oriented schools are choosing remote learning more than their whiter and affluent peers. And the tweet comes from somebody going as Chef Sasha, and it says, a friend is a principal in middle school in Bed-Stuy. Every child lost at least a cousin, aunt, uncle, etc. The low-income families know how dangerous COVID is. 75% are staying remote. But to follow up on what you just said, bringing it back to the debate, and this, again, is in the context of our 30 Issues in 30 Days series, looking at Trump and Biden on various issues. I mean, I gather from other things in your Twitter feed that you're not a Donald Trump fan. I don't know if you endorse. You could give us whatever political context.
I endorse Biden. I'm endorsing Biden. Absolutely.
Okay. So in that context, maybe on this issue about generally opening schools and being kind of vigilant about that, based on your data, maybe you think on this one Trump is right, or how should I read that?
So I don't think that he is right, and I certainly think this, you know, this particular approach of let's just open everything and not think about it at all is emblematic of many of the problems with the approaches. I think it happens that that, you know, a stop clock is even a stop clock is right twice a day, and I think that you know, having more schools open than are open could be a good decision. But what I think is very unfortunate is that the president has been saying this for months. And actually, I think that in the summer, he sort of sent out this message, and the result was that schools opened in places with high prevalence and not in places with low prevalence. And that somehow the axis of school reopening moved from being about science and risk and trying to mitigate those risks and make this safe into a political statement. Like, if you're with him, your schools are open, and if you're not with him, your schools are closed, which is exactly kind of the opposite of the way I think we'd like to make that decision.
Laura in Westfield, you're on WNYC with Emily Oster. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Good,
I've looked at the percentages very carefully because I'm compromised. It looks like in New Jersey and nationally, they attribute about 30% to the 39 to 49% age group. And I'm just wondering if that's because kids are not likely to get tested. I think I just had a negative COVID test recently. It wasn't that easy to get. And I can't imagine finding a place that's going to take kids, and they don't always have symptoms. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Tell me again the age group that you cited as having a lot of cases.
The 30% category in both nationally, from what I can see in the Times, is about 39 to 49-year-olds, and then the next bump up would be my age group, which is about 50 to 69 maybe. That's the next percentage. Teenagers are sort of on the bottom of that group.
And were you going to relate this to college students somehow? Did I get that from my screen?
Well, no. Oh, yeah. I said, well, you can take your pick. My son's at NJIT. They've done a remarkable job. They have 17 cases that they've had since school started that they've been able to record. They test the sewage water, and I thought that was very interesting. They did close down his dorm for about 5 days. He had to quarantine because it's a dorm of 300 kids. It's a hybrid learning program. I mean, I don't know why we couldn't test groundwater, or gray water, rather, in some of these bigger schools.
Right. Laura, thank you. So there's a few things on the table, and I want to follow up about colleges after you answer the question that she actually asked, this idea of sewage testing, for those of you who've never heard of it, is really interesting in that, what is sewage testing? Well, if they're testing water coming out of the dorm bathrooms, they can get a sense of whether there are any cases in that dorm. And if there are, then they can start testing individuals. So it's a, I guess, relatively inexpensive way of screening, perhaps, for college dorms. But the age group question that Laura was really asking you about, Emily, yeah, what would you say?
Yeah, so I think that there, you know, there's something very interesting in here about, I mean, we're not, but like, there's a question people bring up, which is, we know that kids are less likely to be infected, but we also know that they tend to have asymptomatic infection. I think there's a lot of worry about the idea that, you know, kids are kind of asymptomatically spreading COVID, and that when we open schools, we won't see the infections in kids, but we'll see them kind of in the outside broader community. I think the best evidence we have from that so far comes from New York, which is among the few places that's doing kind of asymptomatic testing of kids in schools. I think other places are planning to start, but, you know, New York has been doing some of this and, you know, by and large, very successfully, but also suggesting that there's actually relatively really quite low rates of kids with asymptomatic COVID. So I think that's sort of encouraging. And I think it's reflecting, you know, back to the college questions, reflecting what we're seeing in a lot of on a lot of college campuses. I've got, you know, we're doing a lot of testing here at Brown, and we have very few cases.
But that kind of goes against some of what's been in the news, right? So, like, if pre-K through 12 schools, your data shows, are not super spreaders, what about colleges and universities in general? Because I've seen at least press reports, which is not necessarily science, it's journalism, but nevertheless, press reports that say a lot of the outbreaks that we're seeing around the country started in places that have big universities where a lot of students came back to live.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think part of what's been a really sort of tricky about this, sort of confusing, is that colleges have been, there have been really different experiences. So we've seen a bunch of places where there are, you know, where there are very significant outbreaks associated with colleges, and then other places where colleges have opened with very few outbreaks. I think the truth is a lot of the differences have to do with how much testing they're doing. So the places that have opened more successfully tend to be doing a lot of testing, a lot of asymptomatic testing. You know, how much is the testing versus the places that are doing the testing also encourage, you know, less risky behavior? I think that's a little bit unclear. But I think the evidence suggests it is possible to run a college campus with relatively low prevalence, but also that it is very possible to run one with larger outbreaks. And there are many cases in which colleges are really driving outbreaks in the community, which is obviously, you know, very, very concerning.
George and Hazlitt, you're on WNYC with Emily Oster. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you? Great show. I'm down here in New Jersey, as you said, and the governor's pretty strict, as Cuomo up there as well. So he just released, I don't know how long ago, the kids to play contact sports, close contact sports, indoor hockey. You are spitting in the kids' faces or spitting in each other's faces playing a game, running around. I don't care if it's outside, inside. You're literally spitting in each other's faces playing a game. Like, so how could you possibly not justify, you know, keeping the schools closed and remote, first off? And second off, isn't it true that COVID-19 is patented, and the people that have that patent means it's man-made? If you can't patent a natural virus, it's man-made, and they also own the vaccine to that, and it's gay.
And I think
these kind of people. So
George, I think that's completely disinformation. Right? Nobody has a patent for COVID-19, do they,
no.
Professor Oster?
No, they do not. No.
Just to be clear. But on his other point about contact sports, and, you know, he was kind of getting at, there may be some schools that are closed but actually allowing after school sports activities. I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah.
But even on allowing those sports activities in general, he mentioned hockey, indoors, spitting in each other's faces. Of course, football has a lot of close contact. It's this season. And I think you've been following some of the lessons from pro sports and the experiments that they've been undertaking to try to control the spread while playing their sports. So what would you say about that?
I mean, I think that there's a very broad point here, which is, you know, we are allowing a lot of things and not allowing schools in a way that suggests that somehow we think schools are especially high risk. And I share the view of the caller that I think that it may well be that some of these sports activities are in fact higher risk. So there's a sort of logical inconsistency. You could say, well, we're going to have both things, or you could say, you know, but if you're only going to have one of them, it seems like the one with the lower risk is the one you'd want to do, particularly given the benefits. In terms of, you know, are these sports actually particularly high risk? I think that that's something we're still trying to understand. There's been a lot of variation in pro sports in how good they are, which probably has a lot to do with kind of the NBA managed their bubble in a really aggressive manner, whereas, you know, I think when professional baseball was a bit looser about that, and the result is, as you might expect, more infections in one place than the other.
I know you got to go in a minute. You know, this week in New York City happens to be the first time since school opened that parents are allowed to opt back in if they chose to start remote. I wonder if you have a prediction or, based on your data, advice, like, go back to school.
I'm interested to see what happens. I think, you know, I would not presume to tell people what to do. I hope that they look at the evidence when they make their choices. You know, my guess is we will not see much of an uptick, but it's interesting. I was talking to someone in North Dakota last week who is going through this same choice, and you might have thought there they have a very aggressive outbreak that people might have actually been opted out. But if anything, he said he's seeing more people opt in relative to the beginning of the school year. So there's a sort of combination of Zoom distance learning fatigue competing with maybe concerns about the virus.
Brown University economics professor Emily Oster, keeping a COVID in schools dashboard, and the author of Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. Thank you so much for all this information today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.